This is an ABC podcast.
The ABC TV drama series Wakefield takes place in a psychiatric hospital in the Blue Mountains, just outside of Sydney. The series is kind of like a fever dream mixed in with some startlingly realistic scenes. As you watch it, you might think it was the product of months and months of research, and it is. The series creator, Kristen Dunphy, has spent time in these institutions herself. She's even written TV episodes while inside psychiatric care. Kristen Dunphy has won awards for her work on the SBS series East West 101, the ABC's The Straits, and Network 10's White Collar Blue. Kristen's written for Heartbreak High, for Wildside, Miss Fisher's Murder Mysteries, and GP. But she's never written anything quite as personal as this. Kristen says that the central message of Wakefield is that we're all bonkers. We all have our own forms of crazy, that none of us is completely sane, and it would be a boring old world if we were. Hi, Kristen.
Hi.
The character Ivy, who's in Wakefield, who's got a little baby and has postnatal depression and a couple of issues. How much of that is you?
Quite a lot. I think there's a little bit of me in a lot of the characters in Wakefield, but I think Ivy is a bit more specific. Yes, I had postnatal depression, so I was able to write Ivy very easily.
Postnatal depression you suffered came after the birth of your son, Aidan. He was your second child. What was different with Aidan?
Yeah, I didn't really have a problem with my first child. I had an oversupply problem with breastfeeding. That didn't manifest for the first child in reflux. But what happened with my second child is he developed reflux, which was undiagnosed. So he was screaming 24/7. He was, you know, turning himself inside out sort of screaming, where I just remember feeling incredibly desperate. Both of us were, my husband and I, and just unable to help this child. And we would go to GPs and we would go to casualty and people were saying, well, you know, he's just a grisly baby. He wasn't screaming the way he screamed at home when we'd take him in. And then they'd say, oh, you know, a bit of a nervous mum. And I'm like, it's my second child, you know. But by the time we got into a paediatrician, he was quite horrified and said, this child's extremely unwell. He's got very, very bad reflux and I can't understand why nobody's, like, looked at the obvious, put him on medication. And he said he should be turned around in a week. Well, unfortunately, by then, I had already started to spiral. It was too late.
So he turned around in a week, but you weren't able to?
No. Well, we moved house in that week.
Oh, God.
It was just a bad coincidence. And we also both got rotavirus, my son and I, somehow. And all these things compounded. And I just completely collapsed, felt like I couldn't function. I was just completely overwhelmed with anxiety and despair. I had a two-year-old and I just couldn't function and I almost wanted to protect her from seeing the state that I was in.
Were you under financial pressure at the time too?
Yes, we were. And I guess all of this just compounded in me just sort of having a collapse, and I think the doctor recommended that I could go into St. John of God postnatal unit in Burwood.
Is that like Trezillion or something different from that?
Oh, it's a step beyond Trezillion. Most of the women in there are very unwell. And so it was devastating. It was a psychiatric hospital. So, and I just never thought I'd find myself there, even though I'd had some past experience being unwell, but I didn't think I'd end up in a psychiatric hospital.
Did you have your baby with you in that hospital?
I did. At first I had, because of the rotavirus, I went in by myself. So I was the only woman in the ward without her baby. Once the baby had recovered enough, the baby came, well, Aidan came in with me, because the way that the ward works is you need to have your baby with you because they're helping you to look after your baby and bond with your baby.
So you were writing for TV at the time. How were you able to keep working while you were going through all of this?
I felt like I didn't have a choice. I was booked in to write an episode of All Saints. We were having financial problems at the time. I needed to do that. So I spoke to the doctors about it. Can I write this in hospital? And they had to think about it, and they basically decided the more normality we can maintain here, the better chance of recovery. So I didn't tell the people that I was working for where I was, and my husband came in, you know, because I was shuffling around in fluffy slippers and pajama pants. So he brought in some work clothes for me and some nice shoes, and off I trotted to the plotting meeting and spent the day there. I think I took half a tranquilizer before I left, just to dull the anxiety. And I spent the day there, came back, changed back into the pajama pants. And
did you tell anyone in the script meeting where you'd come from?
Oh, no, absolutely not.
So what does that tell you about humans, that humans can compartmentalize like that? I mean, it sounds like you put your professional hat on.
And I did. I don't know how I did that, looking back on it, but I think sometimes humans, it depends on the mental illness, but we can compartmentalise these disorders, or depending on what it is, of course. But so many of us do. So many people are out there working who have mental illness who don't tell anyone because it's so unacceptable.
I can't help but think, if you're writing for All Saints, you're writing a hospital drama about nurses. What did the nurses think about the fact, at this hospital, think about the fact you were going off for the day to run an episode of All Saints?
Well, they were looking after the baby while I was gone.
Right.
And when I arrived back, they were like beside themselves going, what's going to happen? What's going to happen? Oh, my God, we're such great fans of this show. And so I would, they would look after the baby for a number of hours a day while I would go into a room with my computer and tap away. But I was very, very unwell. So I kind of look back and I'm not quite sure how I did it.
How did the episode turn out in the end?
Oh, about a year later, it won an award at the AFIs. Mm. And I remember I turned to the producer I'd been working with and said, oh, because I'd had a couple of champagnes by now. I said, not bad for something that was written from a psych ward. And she just threw her head back and laughed. She thought I was joking. Of course, because no one would ever admit that. Right.
You didn't mean the writer's room. You meant literally.
Maybe that's ward. What she thought I meant.
So were you an anxious child? Was this something that had been with you as a little girl?
I think I was an anxious child. And we probably have, I think we have anxiety in both sides of the family. Many people do. I wasn't shy.
Right. When did you have your first major attack?
I think panic and depression are two sides of the one coin.
How so? Can you just explain that?
Well, I guess it's very important to identify, I've discovered, which is causing which. So some people have predominantly depression, but it makes them anxious that they're depressed, and some people are very anxious. And for me, that it turned out a long way down the track when they identified I was very anxious, and that was causing a snowball effect. And then despair would set in because the anxiety was snowballing and not going away, and that caused major depression on top of anxiety. So they are both linked.
When did it kick in for you?
So at 14, I remember I had these sort of ongoing low-level feelings of being unwell, swollen glands. We kept on thinking I had glandular fever, feeling weak. And the GP, I remember saying, he said to my mother, look, I think we have chronic depression here. And I don't know why, but I just remember my parents. They told me that he'd said this, but I guess they didn't seek any help, and I just sort of muddled through.
What was the family environment like at the time?
Well, we had a very unusual family life, very unconventional family life. And I think it was the contrast between my very unusual family life and the conservative nature of the area I grew up in that was at the heart of this problem.
So you had an unconventional, nonconformist family.
Yes.
But growing up in a conservative suburb.
Yes. So I grew up in Oatley, and Oatley is a, well, it's very wealthy now, but in those days it was sort of working class to lower middle class. And my parents were unusual. My dad was an academic. He was a sociologist who'd gone to Harvard. He was a professor of sociology. So he was interested in human behaviour. My mother was an artist, and we had this family life. They were very progressive. They were kind of rebelling against their own conservative upbringings.
Were they Christians as well?
Yeah, they met in the Christian fellowship at university, married and went to the United States where Dad went to Harvard, and we were born over there. And this is the Kennedy era. The church back then was into civil rights and they got involved with that. So the church was quite radical. So when we came back from the United States and settled here, I was about five. I remember we were still saying grace at the table, and but they found the church here very conservative. And sort of the late 60s, the 70s hit, and they embraced the 70s with huge gusto. They ran these encounter groups, and so encounter groups were these sort of small group work that they would do, and they did it from our home where people were working through personal crises and learning to think about what they want and working through, I guess, relationship issues in a small group setting.
Was that in all the language of dropping your hang-ups, that 70s language?
Yeah, right. Just being free and do right. Your own thing, right. and rebel against convention. And so my parents were, we had a wonderful family life in the sense that my parents had this kind of unusual approach to problem solving.
Conflict resolution.
Conflict resolution.
How did that work?
My parents called it family conference. Well, I'm talking when us kids were in as young as primary school age, we'd have a family conference where they would sit us down and we would all go around in a circle and say how we were getting along and how we weren't getting along with each family member. I remember one particular instance. We were having particular problems in the family and about morning routine, and my mother was kind of getting to the end of her tether, and so my parents suggested that we swap roles. It was like a play.
So what, you were the parents and the parents were the kids?
So my older brother and I were the parents, and my parents squeezed themselves, literally, into our school uniforms, and they were bulging really? Out of these uniforms.
Right.
Anyway, they were making all this racket, and I was trying to be the mum and trying to get the lunches ready. And the penultimate moment in all of this chaos was my eldest brother walked down from upstairs, sat down in the middle of the chaos in an armchair and opened the paper and started reading it. And my dad looked at him and said, I think I just got the message.
Well, that sounds pretty good to me. I mean, that sounds like a great fun way to take care of things. But nonetheless, if your nonconformist parents are all about that, losing your hang-ups, talking it through, if they've got a daughter who's feeling anxiety, did you think you didn't quite fit into that picture then?
Look, I think what happened was as I moved into teenagehood and I had my own social life, the contrast between how conservative, you know, it was a sort of puberty blues territory. My brothers were surfers. We went to the beach. It was that puberty blues surfing culture.
Sexually adventurous, going out, hanging out, getting drunk a bit too young.
Yes, but quite misogynist. Like I was the girl on the beach getting the meat pies for the boys. You know, it was quite conservative in that sense. So I think the contrast between what was going on at home, I was very sort of embarrassed by my family, a little bit ashamed of how different we were. There was a crazy time. The 70s were crazy, and my parents they gave us a lot of freedom as teenagers, and I don't think I felt safe. The idea was that they were allowed to do whatever they wanted, and we were allowed, they didn't put the normal rules down that parents do. And it was a pretty radical time. So there was sex and drugs and fast cars and drink driving, no seat belts. I don't think I felt 100% safe. I think I was craving more boundaries.
So out of school, going to uni, then you get into adulthood. Tell me about how you got your first job in the United States.
Yeah, so I had gone overseas with my parents. My dad had gone on sabbatical and I thought, oh, great, free trip, went away with them. And I met a man in the States and he came over back to Australia with me for a few years. And then when he returned to the United States, I went to visit him. And by this time I'd done my degree and I wanted a job, so I just rang up the Australian Broadcasting Corporation and said, have you got a job? And they said, well, somebody's just gone back to Australia for a few months. Would you like to be a production assistant?
And where was this?
This was ABC New York.
Oh, right. So it was like that in those days. You just rang up and said, oh, can I have a job with the ABC in New York? And they went, all right.
Yes.
Is that what happened?
Right. Well, it was a bit like that. And then the first day I was working for them, having never worked before in my life, their shuttle blew up.
The space shuttle?
Yeah.
So you were right that you came in through the door just as there was a major news story. What do you remember of that?
Oh, everyone screaming at me.
Why?
Because I was in a technical kind of job. I was a production assistant and everyone was screaming at me.
You didn't know the technology at that point.
Yeah, I didn't know what I was doing. So it was pretty traumatic day, but I still stayed in this job for a few months. And then I came back to Australia with a very impressive reference, because anything from New York back then, didn't matter what it was or how short it was. And I ended up using that reference and posting around to various production companies and struck gold when Sandra Levy, who was making the film High Tide, said, yeah, look, I need an assistant to Gillian Armstrong, director's assistant. So that was my first job.
What was your role on that film?
I was researching for Gillian Caravan Park Life. Because,
really?
Yes.
So how do you research Caravan Park? By living in a caravan park?
I went and lived in a caravan park.
Right.
And I literally would go into the toilets in the caravan park and sit on the toilet with the lid down and write down people's conversations.
That's gold. Fantastic.
I absolutely loved it. Gillian loved my research. I wrote these long reports and she wanted this atmospheric research. And so I just loved doing research for writers. So that's how I started.
About, what on earth do people talk about? Like, what did they talk about in the amenities block?
Well, I can't remember, know it was, it really gave women actually talk a lot in toilets.
They do.
And also just the general atmosphere of a very downtrodden caravan park on the outskirts of Sydney. And I was very creative with my research and would describe, you know, visually as well. And I think that was the beginning of me really feeling like, wow, this would be a really good way to go is drama writing.
So you got attached to the ABC TV series GP.
Yes, well, Sandra was shortly after made head of drama, so she took me into the ABC with her. She said, why don't you go and work as a trainee script editor
and what did
researcher.
That mean? What did that mean? What was the job for that?
Well, I started off doing more of that kind of research for writers on things like Paper Man and, you know, these wonderful ABC shows. And then eventually I went on to this show called Last Resort and then on to GP. And by that time I was trainee script editing, which meant that I was learning on the job. Well, you had to come up with story ideas. That was the main part of it.
It was fast turnaround TV then, was it?
Yeah, well, it was fast turnaround. It was 1 hour a week. And not only did we have to script edit very, very experienced writers, all the top writers working on television writers. So we learnt an enormous amount from them. They were very kind and generous. But we were the fodder that had to come up with story ideas. So every week we'd be sitting there on a Monday morning having been drinking all weekend. You know, we were all share housing and in our 20s and having had no sleep across the weekend. And we were, okay, where are your story ideas? And you'd have to pitch every Monday, just scrabbling around with bits of newspaper clippings and, oh, you know, two lesbians want to have a baby. And they'd go, that's not a story idea. That's a topic. The people we were working to were very, very hard on us, which I actually really appreciate. they were really trying to teach us what a story is.
So you've gone from working with breaking news in New York to working on a feature film to working on a really rapid turnaround TV series. This is all quite demanding work.
Yes.
What brought about another anxiety breakdown with you while you were working on GP?
Well, I'm not sure on a deeper level what was going on. I think I'd had a breakup with this boyfriend who I'd been involved with for 7 years, the one in the United States. So maybe that was the sort of deep foundation there. But my flatmates and I went out one night. We were smoking drugs with some people we didn't know, and all three of us were stoned for 24 hours. So I think it might have been laced with something, I'm not sure.
Or really high-powered THC.
Yeah, something. Anyway, occasionally I'd had this hallucinogenic response to dope, so I don't know what, but I didn't smoke a lot. It was just socially. But anyway, so my other two flatmates came out of this 24-hour stoned thing and I felt like I didn't. Like I felt like I was still stoned and I couldn't get out of it. I couldn't get back to reality. But in actual fact, I was having a panic reaction to what I was experiencing. So it felt like I was in a different dimension. It was absolutely terrifying.
Well, did you feel like you were trapped outside of yourself
yes,
or something?
Yes.
Trapped outside of yourself?
Yes.
That sounds both incredibly strange and incredibly frightening.
It's very frightening. And a lot of people can have this feeling without having smoked any drugs. Some people feel, it's called depersonalization, just sort of slightly outside of themselves.
But super powerful dope can absolutely bring on, yes. brings whatever might be latent right up to the surface. Now, I've heard this that told again and again.
It can trigger schizophrenia. Yeah, that's indeed. What, I mean, people need to be very aware if they've got an anxiety problem that taking drugs can be quite dangerous.
And that was you.
That was me, and I was 2 months off work.
2 months?
I could not function. I was absolutely devastated by the experience.
What were you doing? Do you remember much about that time, what you were doing?
I was going back and forth between my parents' place and my home. I saw psychiatrists, I saw psychologists. I'm not sure what I was doing. I was just paralysed and unable to function. But I would go around and see friends. I had a friend who had a baby, so I would sit. Well, I wanted to be in company. I wasn't hiding away, but I just could not work or function. I couldn't think straight. And I know now that I was in just a really severe panic. I had a panic disorder. I had a very bad sort of crisis one day where I took off to the Blue Mountains of all places.
The Blue Mountains.
Yes.
And where Wakefield is set.
Yes. And I didn't know. I made this last minute decision I would get the train up to the Blue Mountains. I was feeling suicidal. I don't think I had an idea that I was going to do something terrible, but I was in a panic. That is all I can describe it. Didn't tell anyone I was going. Disappeared for the day. Everybody was at home worrying. This is the days before mobile phones. Desperately worried about me. I didn't even think about anybody.
What did you do when you got to the Blue Mountains?
So I got up there by train, got off at Katoomba. I was wandering around the streets in distress, crying. I ended up wandering into the church there. Nobody was in there. I remember sitting there sobbing. And I had these two Xanax, which is a type of tranquilizer, which I'd been told not to take, which, you know, I was always very good about not doing, you know, about doing as I was told. So I hadn't taken Xanax because I've been told by the psychiatrist, you know, that this is a potentially addictive substance, so you're not allowed to take it.
So you took it in desperation then?
I took it, yeah. I felt like I got to a point where I felt like I'm either going to throw myself on the tracks or I could take this. This was the choice I felt I had. So I took these two Xanax, and I remember being on the train coming home and suddenly I felt normal. I felt normal for the first time in 2 months, and I was like, I had this sort of epiphany, like, well, if I'm only two tranquilizers away from being normal, then I don't need to kill myself. It sounds terrible, but I think it just made me realise I wasn't crazy. I was actually quite close to being normal.
The act of taking those tranquilizers is a little bit like a sacrament. It's a bit like, I do have a problem.
Yes.
That needs to be addressed. And the act of taking the tranquilizers is a way of acknowledging that. Do you think there's anything in that?
I think so. And I also think that, you know, I think people are very, very worried about tranquilizers because if they're taken in large amounts and in increasing amounts, they can become addictive. But I do believe, and I've talked to Dr. Cross about this as well, Dr. Mark Cross, who worked on Wakefield, that sometimes the use of a tranquilizer can remind somebody with a very bad panic disorder that they're not going crazy, whatever crazy is, they are just anxious and that they can get back to normality. Lots of people walk around with a tranquilizer in their handbag and they feel better because they have it there, but they don't need to take it.
Podcast, broadcast, and online. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler. Find out more about the Conversations podcast. Just head to abc.net.au/conversations.
So you said you came back from the Blue Mountains after this terrible several months of suffering from panic and you took the tranquilizers and suddenly felt a lot better as a result. When you got back to work, did you tell people what you'd been going through?
No, I think people knew I'd had some sort of a breakdown, but we didn't talk about it.
Right, it was skirted around.
No, I think I told my Tim Pye, who was my boss at the time, the story producer, I told him about the dope that I'd smoked and how that had triggered it. People were understanding, but it was not really something, I didn't hide it from the writing department, but it's not something you sort of talked about, really.
So then years later, the next major incident was after your son Aidan was born, which we were talking about right at the start here.
Yeah.
And you had terrible anxiety and you went into a psychiatric hospital and Aidan was, your baby boy was able to join you there for a while. How did you start to get well from that? What was your recovery like, Kristen?
I was in there for quite some time. I went in there, of course, feeling like everybody was mad. This was the first time I'd ever been into a hospital and I thought, I don't belong here.
Does everyone feel like that when they go into an institution?
I think a lot of people do. I met a woman called Fiona who I sort of made friends with and pretty early on and she was like, I don't belong here. These people are crazy and you don't belong here. And we were both sort of had this kind of almost superior attitude.
Was it your little secret, was it?
Yes, it was like we're the only normal ones. Well, really, we were the last to leave. That is really the joke. And I guess that's what really inspired James, part of what inspired the first story in Wakefield about James, who sees himself as separate and better than everybody else. And it takes a long time for some people to recognise that they're actually just as ill as everybody else.
Well, I mean, there's the word unwell and there's crazy, isn't there? I mean, I'm not crazy, but is it easier to accept you might be unwell?
Yes. And I guess being in a psychiatric ward is just a very humbling experience. It's like you get to the point where you just have to recognise that, look, I'm broken. Everyone in here is broken in some way. And in a way, it sort of brings you to the level of everyone, and there's a kind of freedom in that.
You mean like that tower you can build for yourself as you get older in life, you know, of your dignity or something that gets knocked over?
When you lose your dignity, in a way, the only way is up. And I guess eventually they tried various, you know, antidepressants, and I think it was a drug that, well, I guess it's a combination of things that they put me on a particular antidepressant, I think, at the time that did have some effect. They also were very supportive with the baby, so they would take your baby during the night so you could get a decent night's sleep and help you bond with the baby. And the other part of getting better, I think, was just realising that I wasn't the only one, that there were other women who were unable to bond with their babies for whatever reason. Because I think not having the right emotions towards your baby is a huge taboo. It's a terrible feeling. It feels all wrong. You're a mother. This is your baby. You should have these feelings towards this baby, and you're not feeling it. It's because you're unwell, but you still feel terrible about it, and it feels wrong. But realizing that you're not alone in that, that has a very strong impact, shame.
I think humans are supposed to feel that complete wave of total adoration and love. Is it like you can still feel the love, but it's just a more complicated love? It's like there's the love, but then I'm also sort of losing my mind over all this other stuff that's going on. What is it?
Well, for me, the love was, I guess, lost amongst panic. So what happened?
So the love doesn't solve the problem of the panic, in other words, and you feel bad about that.
Well, you can't feel the love because of panic. So for me, every time Aiden cried, and, you know, yes, he had this high-pierced cry. When I wrote the dialogue for Ivy, she was saying, I'm allergic to her, about her daughter. I felt allergic to Aiden's scream. And it becomes like a Pavlov's dog response. You know, the baby has this particular scream. Now, every woman in this P&D ward knew their baby's cry and didn't want to hear that particular cry. The other babies didn't cause this response. So it was really interesting to have this friend in there, Fiona, that I made, because her baby had a very high-pitched scream, but it didn't affect me. The same went for Fiona. When she heard my baby, she could bond with my baby and I could bond with her baby in a way I couldn't my own, because of this feeling like it pierced you inside when you heard your baby scream. It was like an immediate allergic reaction. And that takes a while to go away when it's established. It's a brain synapse thing. It's a response that you develop, and it feels like you're allergic to your own child. You love the child.
All new parents get it, but maybe just don't, like, you know, as soon as the baby starts to cry, it really snaps something in your head. It's amazing. You know, it's true for fathers as well as
yes,
mothers.
Yes.
But maybe what happens is you just get it much, 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 much more so. Maybe the volume's turned up to
110. Yes, and I wanted to run away. Every time I heard the cry, I wanted to run, because it was causing me to feel so terrible.
To panic.
Yes. And that panic very quickly leads to despair. So, you know, it becomes depression.
One of the cleverest things in Wakefield, and spoiler alert here, this is the thing I think when I knew it was a bit special, was Ivy goes out, she's released, she is out with her baby, but she realises that people can't see that she's broken. And so Nick, the nurse, gives her a moon boot, like the kind of boot you put on when you've got a broken ankle. And she goes out into the world, and straight away everyone can see that she's broken, even though she's not got a broken ankle, and rush to help her with her pram, incredibly solicitous of her, because they can see the brokenness. That's very clever.
Yes, because mental illness is so invisible. And I guess where I got that idea from is that it struck me that I've had 3 moon boots in my life. I've done,
You've only got 2 feet.
Done my ankle 3 times, different ankle injuries. And the attention that I got when I was wearing a moon boot, everybody was like, oh, no, what have you done? Oh, you poor thing. And this is like way beyond when I had babies. But I just decided, it just struck me that, you know, I never felt like the ankle things was a big deal, because, you know, mental illness, in many ways, it's so much more agonizing than physical illness. It's a psychic illness. It's an illness of the soul.
The public expressions of compassion are much easier for someone with a broken ankle than for someone with mental illness. People never know quite what to say, I think.
No, they don't. Often they don't know, because we're so ashamed we don't want to tell anyone. And then if you do say something, often people are just, they don't want to make it worse. They don't know what to say. Yeah. They're all uncomfortable. I find that fascinating. I think it's very sad. I'd like it to change.
You had another bout of anxiety 10 years after that in 2008. How did you come to have electroconvulsive treatment for that anxiety at the time?
Well, I guess it was treatment for major depression. That has to be my official diagnosis, just because medication-related reasons.
It was to treat the depression, not the anxiety, is what you're saying?
I guess so. These things are never really separate, but I guess I was diagnosed with major depression and they were treating it as depression. It was later that somebody figured out the panic was at the heart of the problem. But the point where I was at when I had ECT, I was being treated for major depression and they tried me on many, many medications, various antidepressants, lithium, Seroquel, all kinds of different, and nothing was working. They were kind of at the end of the road. And I guess the idea of ECT was pretty horrifying, having seen One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which is most people's experience of or knowledge about ECT.
So when you agreed to it, was that controversial within your family and extended friends?
Yes, my family were very against it. Most people are horrified by the idea of ECT, but actually ECT has changed. It's come a long way. It was completely painless. And to be honest, I saw people miraculously cured through ECT during my stay in hospital.
Do you recall it? I mean, because it wipes memory, doesn't it, to some degree?
You know, I had quite a lot of ECT over a period of time. You're not aware you're having it because you're given medication. So you don't remember once you've had the anaesthetising injection and you wake up in bed. So it's completely painless. But they told me it would wipe some memory and it did wipe significant amounts of my memory, which was pretty distressing.
Do you get those memories back?
I got some of them back, but there are big blanks. It's like the old cassette tapes, you know, when you used to press record accidentally and there'd be a little patch that's missing. So, yeah, there are blanks in my memory, but it didn't work for me. And it probably went on a bit long before I was able to finally really assert myself and say, this isn't working. And I didn't want to assert myself because I thought this was the last resort. So I didn't want to admit that to myself that it wasn't working because I thought there was no other hope. So it took me a while before I finally kind of just put my foot down and said, look, this just with my husband's help, we both just said, look, enough's enough, this isn't working. But I wanted to put ECT into Wakefield because I think it's much misunderstood. It really has helped a lot of people. I don't regret having it. I had to give it a try.
There's an amazingly loving and patient husband in Wakefield. Is that your husband?
It's very much inspired by my husband, who my friends called The Rock, because he just was very steady and strong through the whole number of years that I was so unwell.
How common is it for people in these institutions to say this, like you said before, I'm not like these other people, I don't belong here?
Look, I think it's pretty common. I think particularly for somebody's first admission, I think a lot of the time it's just a protective response, I guess, thinking that you're somehow separate to this world. Because the irony is you go into a psychiatric hospital because you can no longer function in the outside world. You need refuge and you go in there to get better. But in many ways, when you first get there, a lot of people are making you feel worse. The other patients are making you feel worse. So it feels counterintuitive, I suppose, when you're in there and you just think, who are all these crazy people? And it takes a while to realise you're one of them.
You're making other people feel worse too, perhaps.
And I think that's what I was so interested in, was how patients affect one another, how staff affect patients, how patients affect staff. And, you know, I've spoken to so many people in the mental health business and over the years, and they all say, look, we're all batshit crazy ourselves.
Really, the staff? Well, I suppose that's fair enough. How normal, quote unquote, are the staff? Do they have to be a little bit crazy to work there too, or do they know that?
Well, I think a lot of people that are attracted to that profession, it's no secret, a lot of them are really often attracted to the profession because they have something in them that they, some issue they need to deal with. But I think human beings, you know, this is my point. I think human beings are pretty crazy. Like, it depends what you call crazy.
Yeah, well, I was just going to say that because some of the staff there would surely be those amazing people who want to heal the world, who want to fix a broken world. That's crazy to try and think you can make the broken world unbroken, isn't it? I mean,
yes.
That's kind of beautifully crazy though, isn't it?
It is. Look, being human means that you are imperfect, that you sometimes get overwhelmed. There are people working in mental health who have serious mental health issues. I've probably had about 10 psychiatrists in my life, and two of them were diagnosed with quite serious mental illnesses I discovered later. So I think some people have serious mental illnesses who are working in mental health, but also just being human, I don't think any of us, we're either all normal or we are all crazy. We are all on a spectrum. I don't believe there's this us and them. And I guess what I've come to realise is that just because people are not completely sane doesn't mean they can't help you. So, you know, I was kind of worrying about making Wakefield, I don't want to show too much of this, you know, the staff having these mental health problems, because I want to make sure that people seek help when they're unwell, and maybe they'll be afraid that, you know, what's the point of going and getting help if the people you're getting help from are crazy themselves? Well, actually, because of this ability to compartmentalise things, really, just because somebody has a problem doesn't mean they can't help you.
Years and years ago, I interviewed the completely wonderful Brenda Blethyn, the actress.
Yes.
And just putting aside the fact she's one of the funniest people I've ever interviewed, funny to the point where the immediate area around where I was interviewed was rather damp with all sorts of things. She's made me laugh so much. She was very, very funny. She said to me something that was so interesting, and I've thought about it ever since. She said, no matter what character she's playing, no matter how terrible that person is, she feels she has to not only like that person, but to be able to defend them. Because that's how we think when we're in our own skin, no matter what we do or even how terrible we are. She must be able to feel that, and otherwise she can't act the part unless she does that. And other actors have said that to me as well. I wonder what you think about that. I mean, that gives you kind of an insight into brokenness, I think, and how you write drama and how you pretend to be other people.
Yes, well, with Wakefield, I had a terrible time trying to sell the show.
Really?
Sell a show about mental illness. Oh, that's crazy in itself, trying to sell a drama about mental illness. You have to be crazy to try and do that. It was a very big uphill battle. People were like, why would anyone want to watch that? And I guess for me, I wanted to really help the audience get inside the shoes of people who were unwell and be able to do exactly what you were just talking about, which is to say, okay, let's walk in this person's shoes, let's be inside their head for a moment and come to understand what it's like from this person's point of view. That's why Wakefield's quite different, because it has a kind of, we sort of get different stories from the point of view of different people so that we can experience the same event from a different person's point of view, so we start to understand how people are affecting each other. But I guess, too, people were quite concerned that, you know, either it was going to be too tragic, in which case they wouldn't want to watch it, or if it was funny, then we might be laughing at these people. And I was saying, look, it's both. And I felt like, having been a patient, that I had a license to laugh about or see the humour in the situation, the absurdity in some of the situations. But I think it's really important, if you're using humour, which I do use a lot of in Wakefield, that it's compassionate humour. And that's how you get away with it, because people were very nervous about it. We're not going to laugh at these people, are we? And I was like, well, no, because we need to come from a place of compassion, and I think that's what you were just referring to. It's but you need to love and understand the characters with all their faults and come from where they're coming from, so that we then gives us license to laugh.
Here's a really weird question. I don't know how easy it is to answer, but watching it felt to me like I was watching a parallel world, and the really surreal sequences, like dance sequences, music sequences, are all part of that other highly subjective world. How do you feel now? Do you feel it is a separate world, or has that merged with the world you're in the rest of the time, or is it like two worlds you feel you can traverse more comfortably now?
Say, for example, the dance sequence in episode one where we're on the platform and suddenly we're in what I would call fantasy. What we were trying to do there, we were actually extending a catastrophic thought. So we all have catastrophic thoughts, everybody. So you drop your partner off near a bus stop in the car, and as you're driving off, sometimes you might have a flash of, well, what if my partner walks out on the road and gets hit by a bus? And in your mind, you imagine that visually. This is a very common thing that we all do many times a day, depending on how anxious you are, but everybody has catastrophic thoughts. So what we did with that is, in real time, it's quite long, that sequence, but it's just a catastrophic thought that Nick's having at that point. It's just that usually it's half a second, but in order to play it out in real time, it takes quite a while. So we were doing that. But when you get to the episode four where Nick is walking behind himself and he's having a depersonalization moment, that's not a common occurrence. My father had that. He said he had an experience where he was walking 3 feet behind himself for 3 weeks. He didn't seek medical attention. I think he had a deep distrust of the medical profession, and particularly psychiatry. He just came out of it after 3 weeks. But he literally felt like he was outside his body for 3 weeks, and that is a form of anxiety.
It's a funny old world, isn't it?
It is. People are experiencing all these weird things and not telling anybody, which is quite interesting in itself.
Congratulations on the success of Wakefield. It's been great speak with you, Kristen. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.